brings back memories of my native Texas.
Do you ever go back?
Yes, I do. I go back not once a year, once every 2 years, to visit what's left of my family.
They where is Houston. Where is your? Oh, Houston. Has it changed a lot?
Yes.
Yes.
Because I haven't. I moved to go up north, go to Ohio, and go to school. So that was in 48.
Mm.
So I came up north, and so my only connection to the South now is to visit relatives, and my father still lives in Houston, my brother.
Oh, that's nice.
But yeah, it's changed. It's I remember I didn't know about segregation in those days, but I, as I look back now, I remember the drinking fountains.
I remember the drinking fountains.
Yeah. It would be for, one would say, whites and Negroes.
I had a friend who, a daring friend, and her mother told her if she drank out of the black one, she would turn colors. And so she went and drank to see, and she didn't turn any colors.
And indeed, the blacks did sit in the back of the bus.
Oh, yeah.
And they sat in the balcony. But I didn't feel any, I had no feeling of racial discrimination. I mean, we didn't live with blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And we had no contact with blacks. Everything, our schools were all white.
Yeah.
And so it was another world, and I didn't know they were being discriminated against.
You really didn't?
No. Well, I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
And I started the second grade in Houston, and I left Houston to enter the sixth grade up in Ohio.
Yeah.
And felt very strange. I would say, ma'am, and I'd stand at my desk and say, yes, ma'am. And
how'd you lose it?
Well, you
purposely
do that.
Purposely, or?
You do that, especially if you study to become a broadcast journalist.
Oh.
It didn't take long to lose it. They would snicker. And when you're a kid, you adapt. When you're an adult, you don't change very much. My uncle Bob,
mm-hmm.
from Oklahoma, he is retired now, but he was in charge of Mobil's oil drilling in the North Sea and in the Gulf of Mexico, and a man who lived in London for many years and came to New York, and a world traveler. But when he came, he had this dialect, this Oklahoma drawl, and I thought, boy, is he going to have trouble here? I mean, people are going to think he's a yokel, he's going to think he's a hick. And he admitted that he did have problems.
Oh,
especially if
he was a big popular item.
Well, if he called somebody, he would call a bank to get his account straightened out. And he would talk to an officious clerk. And she would give him a hard time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And because she heard this drawl and she thought he was a hick and a fool.
Sage, yeah.
But he wasn't.
Yeah.
So I noticed that in your novel, Southern Family, there is a scene in, it was a very interesting scene in which, I believe Julia, the mother, I may have the names wrong, I forget.
So Julia's the friend and Lily's the mother.
Lily the mother is in a creative writing class at an adult education school, and is asked to talk about what she did as a reporter and her efforts to write a novel, but interrupted efforts and so forth. And then she asked everybody to write, and the best essay in the class was about a woman who told the difficulty she had in shopping.
A black woman.
A black woman, yes. And that was very moving, really. And I can understand why she would be moved by that, too, especially... I don't remember exactly when that scene took place.
It's a flashback actually early in the book. The mother Lily is having a massage by her black masseuse, and she's remembering how they became friends, and that's when the masseuse asked if she would speak to her writing class. And when she got there, it was a room full of black women, and she asked them to write something, and she said, "Just write, tell me something that happened. It can be anything, even something like going shopping." She wanted to be, you know, make them feel at ease. And so this one woman said, really? Can it be anything? And mother said yes. And so the lady wrote about shopping in this small town in the 1940s, and how when you went into a store first of all, you couldn't try anything on. So the mother would have to guess the sizes of the children because you couldn't bring anything back. And the other thing was they never had any stockings the right color. They only had one color, and they thought that would be fine for all blacks, and it was a color called Red Fox. I remember those stockings in the store. They were a deep red. They were the red of a fox. And so what the black women would do, they would take these home, and they got very skilled at dyeing them with coffee grounds or tea leaves, just to the right shade. They knew just how to get their shade. And the mother in the book, Lily, is very moved by this. And the next time she goes into a greeting card shop, she wants to buy a card for her black friend's new grandbaby. And she goes in, and she suddenly realizes that all the cards have white babies on them. And then she thinks, well, I should say something to the manager. You should have cards with black babies on them. And then she starts thinking, but if I sent one with the black baby on it, it might be the wrong thing, too. And then she realizes how very complex it all is, you know, how the black community has internalized the white person's vision of them, so that if they did get a card with a black child on it, they'd think, wait a minute.
It's hypocrisy.
Yeah, hypocrisy.
Isn't it it's outrageous, isn't it, that the degree to which well-meaning people have been immune or have ignored or just been unaware of the problems affecting this huge black community, not only in the South, of course, but also in the North. But, I mean, well-meaning people who would not mean to discriminate.
It'll take probably beyond my lifetime, certainly, until people just forget. I mean, they just look at one another. I hope we get to that and just see another person, because there's still so much history. And I think with white people, there's still so much guilt, even if we personally never kept slaves.
Well, you grew up in Asheville, right?
I grew up in Asheville.
Well, what was it like when you grew up? I mean, obviously it had to be segregated at that
time. It was totally segregated. There were drinking fountains labeled black and white. There were just no bathrooms for the blacks. They sat in the back of the bus. You had people who you knew, maybe the man that swept the church, and you called them by their name, but you would never ask them to your house. But that's all changed, I think. Or it's changing.
It wasn't looked upon as discrimination, though, was it? Nobody felt...
I think most adults knew, but you see, it was their business to keep it from themselves, because that was the system. And they were still... there were still people alive then whose parents and grandparents, whose grandparents could remember the indignities of the Civil War. They could remember their towns being burned and everything. So they were still mad. And I think they took it out a little bit on the black people. There's a lot about that in my book. The young man in the family, the one who dies in the Quick family, he seems to have been born with the sense that the world was unfair, and he's always asking questions that make people very nervous. And first thing he does, of course, is to get a black friend. And they run off together. They have an adventure. And his father, the boy's father, I don't want to go into all this.
Well, the extremes are there. You can also see the white trash snow.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the white trash family lives in with a construction guy in a trailer after leaving Theo and the sort of thing. So you see it all, really. It's all there. Let's talk a little bit about a Southern family and how you came to write this book and what you were trying to do as you wrote it. You don't just sit down and start putting words on paper. You had an idea and a thought, and you wanted to write a story and tell a compelling and moving story, which you did. So what was the genesis of this book?
Well, my last three books have really, the material has really chosen me. It's not always this way, but the last three, A Mother and Two Daughters, the source of that was a letter from a friend telling about a trip she'd taken with her mother and her sister. And then The Finishing School was came out of a dream I had. This book was not a pleasant genesis at all. It was the very violent death of my own brother 4 years ago. And when it first happened, I said to myself, this is something I will never touch. In fact, I had another book I was writing. It was going to be a book about New York. It's called Gotham. And
don't call it Gotham.
Well, it's not going to be called anything now because it's dead. And but I couldn't get this whole thing out of my mind, the death and the questions that it left with me. The main one being, why is it that some people survive the society into which they're born so well and the times into which they're born so well, and others just never do? I mean, they it's as if they're wearing clothes that are cut wrong and the clothes hurt. And so this whole book is a question. Why didn't this boy survive? Of course, then I had to turn it into fiction. You know, fiction writers, even if you start off to write naked autobiography, before you get to the end of the first page, you're telling lies, you're changing things, you're making it into sometimes a bigger truth than the literal facts that you started with. And I decided the only way I could tell a story, since there's no resolution to it, there's a death. No one is quite sure even how the death occurred, but it's violent, and the family goes through a lot of suffering. And I decided to tell it from everyone's point of view and just juxtapose voices. And each of them asked themselves, you know, who was this boy? What did he need? What could I have given him? And then, as people do, they start thinking about themselves. So then they start thinking about their own lives. And it changes some of them quite a bit and changes others not at all. So it's told from the point of view of the mother, the father, the younger brother, the estranged wife, the mountain girl that he's married against his family's wishes, the little child that he has, the three-year-old son, friends of the family, even the nuns that taught him in the school he went to, a foreign man. It's just told from different points of view.
How were the circumstances of your brother's death similar to the death of Theo in A Southern Family?
That I kept absolutely the same. And I can't speak about it too much now, but it's all there in the book. The book, which was 867 pages in manuscript, was finally the only way I could talk about it.
And so that is still a mystery too, to a degree. Huh?
It's a mystery in the real world, and it's a mystery in the book. But what's not so much of a mystery to me is who my brother was. By creating a character called Theo, I think I understand better who a person called Tommy was.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had this this personal tragedy that had marred your life and was a catalyst for writing the book. But all of these other characters, how did they come about? I mean, they weren't just, you didn't just create them arbitrarily. I mean, there had to be people in your lives who possibly were prototypes. Is that correct?
Prototypes. What is a prototype?
Well, maybe that's the wrong composite. Maybe a prototype. I'll use the. They had probably are composites. A prototype, of course, is a first step or a beginning of a product.
Uh-huh.
Or it could be in a fictional level. It could be a character. It could be the beginning of a character who later develops into a real character in a novel or something. I don't know. It's probably a bad term?
Let's see. They are people in this book. There are three kinds of things, really. They're either based on real people, and then I felt free, since this was a work of fiction, to change them or to enlarge on them or to make imaginative guesses. They're also composites. Many of the minor characters are composites of people I've known. And then the third thing I do when I write is, and it's one of the reasons I like to write and need to write, I take various aspects of myself and I send them abroad in different characters. And that's how I can get into people who are on the surface, who would seem to be very unlike myself. There is, for instance, there's a person inside me who could also die violently. There's a person in me who could mourn like a mother, even though I'm not a mother. There are all these people in me. There's a writer who's always worrying about herself, and I put her in the book as the sister. The writer is always worrying that she's not good enough and that her work is not good enough. And
that's you.
That's me, but it's I mean, she worries much more than I do. I made her kind of a I thought, well, maybe if I can just have done with this once and for all, I'll just expose all that darkness in myself and see what happens. But I think she worries even more than I do.
Well, let's talk about the writer's confidence or lack of it. Is mm-hmm. this endemic to being a writer, not having confidence in your work? I have, of course, you are my sixth interview since yesterday.
Oh, my heavens.
And some of them are very important writers, the good writers like yourself, Toni Morrison, people like that. And I'm very interested in psychologically how they approach their work, and then once they finish it, how they view it. Some writers I've talked to are supremely confident that they've written the American novel, and others mm-hmm. are saying, I'm not so sure I should have even published this. So tell me, from your perspective, how does a writer do a lot of bluffing when he finishes or she finishes a book?
My times of greatest self-doubt come during it. I mean, I can look at that book over there on your desk, and it's an entity, and it's finished, and I'm proud of it. I think it is a good book. I put everything I had into it. But when I was writing it, there were many days I just thought, I can't go on with this. It's just nothing, and it's just an approximation. It's not getting anywhere. It's the language isn't good enough. There's so many other stories that I have to put in, but there's no place to put them. And just great soul searching and hair shirting and all that. I suffer mostly when I'm writing it, and when I don't see the finished thing, you know, when I doubt that it'll ever be finished.
I have a feeling that what you're saying, though, you're talking effectively about the mechanical problems, and I wonder if that's any different than... Well, I spend a good portion of my day in this noisy newsroom there in putting newscasts on the air. And, you know, I come in the morning, and sometimes as I go through the copy, it's all in the computer now, and I go through the copy, and I listen to tape and all that, and I just look at the clock, and I say, God, I got to get this out by a certain time, and I don't think I can do it today. I'm not up to it, and I've got telephone calls to make and my series to worry about. But somehow it gets done. And when you are as professional as you are, when you come to grips with these mechanical things, where you say, I just can't go on today, the words aren't right, but you're a professional, and you sit there and you do it.
I guess you're right.
And there isn't any other alternative unless you want to do something else, like
gardening.
That's
right. I like to do that, too.
Well, that doesn't take as much intelligence, but that's fun, I guess. Uh-huh. But it's this is a higher calling, thank God. Well, now, you are a Southern writer. Not all of your books have taken place in the South. The finishing school took place up north, but
upstate.
But they were
Southerners
there. But your major books are all Southern oriented. What has propelled you out of the South? I was talking to James Dickey a week or two ago. He said, except for a couple of forays into the North, he can never leave the South again. It's, he likes the folkways, and he's still in Columbia. And he likes the music and the people and the food and all that, and he considers himself Southern to the core. But somehow you've, I don't know if you've broken with the South, but you've left it.
No, I haven't really. I mean, I guess I never will. I mean, look at me up here writing about it. I miss a lot of things about it. I miss the graciousness of the people, and there is still a little bit more leisurely style down there, but it's changing fast. I think fate just propelled me out. I mean, I went to college down there at Chapel Hill, and then worked on the newspaper in Miami, the Miami Herald. That's in the South, but it's not Southern. Then I went to Europe because I'd always wanted to go, and I thought that's what you did if you wanted to be a writer. And then came back to New York and worked here as a fact checker for about 6 months for a magazine. And then I went to the University of Iowa, studied at the workshop, and then ended up back in New York. And I go back to the South quite a lot visiting, but I'm real happy up here looking down there.
Well, of course, you have friends here now and, and a life here, and I guess, like myself, I go back to visit.
That's right.
But circumstances, going to college in the North and finding job, you know, one thing that journalists do, they go where their work is.
That's right.
Your work took you to Miami and other places, so you go where the work is, and so you find yourself there. I guess I can still consider Houston my home, but I'm not sure I'd ever want to go back, even though I have a fondness for it. The last time I spoke to you, I don't know if you recall, you were reading a statement at the Penn Faulkner. What's the award?
Oh, the Penn Hemingway Award.
It wasn't Penn Hemingway.
What could it have been?
Oh. The American Book Awards.
Oh, and the sound system was terrible, and everybody was eating their hors d'oeuvres.
Well, I could hear you fine.
Well.
It was Doctorow won the fiction prize, and you had gone to Baltimore, a rainy Tuesday in Baltimore.
Yes, we went down, the other judge and myself went down to see the third judge, Ann Tyler. Because she didn't want to come to New York, and I'm always willing to get on a train for any purpose. So we went down there to make the final choice.
Boy, that must have been tough.
It was tough because Peter Taylor and Norman Rush and Dr. Rowe, was there another one, or was that all? Was that the three? Yes. Peter Taylor.
Were there three or four? I don't remember now.
No, Peter Taylor for Summons to Memphis. That's still one of my favorite books.
Yeah.
And Norman Rush's book called Whites, which is about people in South Africa. Fascinating book. And Doctorow. I'm not repressing one. I think that was
the three. I'd have to check it, but I think
there are three, yes, because I remember in my speech I said when I went down, we had three winners, and then when I came back on the train, we had to have two losers and one winner.
Well, books are so different.
Those three were so different. One was about a boy growing up in New York. One was about the subtle, sinuous mores of the South. And the third was about a young professional couple in South Africa working for the government.
That's all I can't see.
I mean,
how can you get the best?
And they were all the very best of their kind, those three books.
Yeah.
So it was rough.
Yeah. So, and that doesn't, and the fact that Dr. O won it doesn't depreciate Whites.
No.
Or
Summons to Memphis.
Summons to Memphis. And in effect, I was reading the introduction today. I was reading the introduction to the collection of short stories that you helped edit. And when stories are so radically different, the best is almost impossible. Themes are different, style is different.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, it's kind of an interesting exercise. But some, I just kind of wish they wouldn't call it the best.
I do too. And also when you're a judge, I'm not going to be a judge of anything for a long time. Your mood changes. One night, this might be your favorite story. The next night, you see a quality in another one. I mean, you should just have perhaps an anthology called My Favorite Stories and not have any, and don't put them in any hierarchy. But we're climbing creatures. We love these hierarchies.
My picks click for the year.
My picks, my clicks, my pants, my...
It's like, I guess it's like music. I happen to like, I'm very fond of classical music, but I also happen to like banjo music, and I also like standards, old music, and
too.
Jazz and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what if I, what if one were to collect a music library of all jazz? And that's great for a while, but then sometimes you want to hear some Chopin.
That's right.
Or Mozart. And so I think books are the same way.
Yeah, why not all?
When you, of course, are you influenced by the people that you read? Obviously, you must read. I mean, every fiction writer must read, as Updike once told me, just to find out what's going on.
Uh-huh. There's a lot of that kind of fiction today that you read just to find out what other... elements of society are doing, or other people in other parts of the world. I read a great deal. I read old things. I read new things. I probably am influenced by them, but and I probably would be the last person to tell you who influences me the most. Sometimes I'm caught in horror when I see that I've just blatantly stolen something from somebody. My first novel, was called The Perfectionist, and I named the heroine. Her first name was Dane, D-A-N-E, and then I realized sometimes later I'd been reading Henry James's story, The Great Good Place, and the man in that is called George Dane. And I just picked it up. Well, now that's a simple, easy thing.
It could have been worse. It could have been Scarlett O'Hara.
Oh, yeah, right. and if it goes into names, it must go into other things.
Well, in fact, Updike, when I did that interview with him, said that he liked to read to find out what other people are doing, so he doesn't do that.
Ah.
He's afraid that he will do what other people are doing and when he didn't mean to do it.
I'm never afraid of that.
Well, tell me what you're working on now and what can we expect from you within the next couple of years. Or is that, should I not ask that?
Well, you know, I just finished this book in January. It came out rather quickly. I've never seen such a production.
Southern Family?
Yes. I turned it in, the final revised
manuscript. It's been three quarters of a year.
In January. And then I wrote several other things, several short pieces. And now there's something building in me, but I don't know where it's going. I just have a sentence. I mean, with one book, I had a letter from a friend, and that started the book. And one, I had a dream, and this, I had a tragedy. And the book I have now, I have one sentence. I don't know what it'll turn into, but it's a sentence that interests me. So
it's the creative process is fascinating, isn't it? Because
it
nobody
is.
Knows how it works.
And there are always surprises, and you never can. Just lay out your program for the year, because there's always going to be something you didn't plan for, and sometimes those things are good things.
Of course, with you, you're much more of a cerebral writer. If you were Evan Hunter, who's a very good writer, isn't like you at all. He writes maybe one good book every 2 years, mm-hmm. and then a lot of little mysteries in between, as you know.
That would be fun.
What's that?
That would be fun to write little mysteries in between.
He does. He does. He writes under the name Ed McBain.
Oh, of course. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know the two were the same.
Yeah, it's the same guy. So, but he likes to put his name on what he considers his good stuff. But his good stuff, as I say, is not really cerebral. It's very well planned, plotted, not much different from his mysteries in some mm-hmm. respects. His last major novel, for example, was about Lizzie Borden.
Hmm.
So in a way, it's easy. If you get fascinated by the Lizzie Borden murder case, you could build a novel around it, and the research is all done for you practically.
Right.
So in fact, strangely enough, when he wrote that novel, somebody else wrote I'm pretty sure it was also a novel with the same title. It came out the following month.
What?
There were two Lizzie. They were both called Lizzie Borden, I believe.
Oh. Did they get reviewed everywhere together? Probably.
No. Evans got the predominant reviews because his name is bigger.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a fluke. Really strange. Unfortunate for that, especially for that other publisher.
Yeah.
But at any rate, that's different in a way. You could say, I want to write about... I'm interested in automobile racing. I'm interested in building a story around the Indianapolis Speedway. And you can do that. I mean, you could come up with characters and so forth. But with you, you had that tragedy, and all of your things began with a dream or a sentence or an idea or a feeling.
Oh, they all come out of my concerns and my experience. That's what I'm interested in. Although it would be fun to write a mystery, maybe I could be Gail McGodwin every 2 years or so.
Gail McGodwin.
Maybe something a little better.
I like mysteries, but I would do it under a completely assumed name.
Mm-hmm.
All right, because then mysteries, I get in trouble. I do mysteries, and I also do a little science fiction on this broadcast. But it's most of these books are turned out on a much different level. It's a different type of book.
But wouldn't you like to have written The Turn of the Screw? That's a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
I would like
go on.
No, Turn of the Screw, or The Woman in White, or Dickens was writing a mystery when he died.
There are well-done mysteries, and there are mysteries that have gone beyond the genre. The last P.D. James book.
Oh, yeah, she's going beyond it.
Think of the name of it. But that book, when I read that book, I knew it was a mystery, and it had her hero leash in it, but it didn't feel like a mystery.
Oh, it was really a novel of manners, too. It had all those different elements in it, and I enjoyed that one.
But she's an exception, and I've read a lot of mysteries that just weren't very good, they just...
Well, maybe it's because they start with a rigid scheme and then make everything fit into it. The mysteries I like are the ones that come out of character. It's more the mystery of why did this person do it than who did it.
Well, almost all mysteries have a conclusion in which the culprit is brought to justice.
Yeah, called on the carpet.
so the kind of mystery you're talking about, if you're talking about character, it may not... You may not ever know who the murderer is, perhaps.
Or you may know from the very beginning. There's one that Ruth Rendell wrote, and I don't remember the title of it. And it's about a woman who works as a maid, and her big secret is that she's illiterate, and it really bothers her. And she's hidden it all her life, and then she goes to work for these new people, and the wife keeps leaving her notes. And she gets madder and madder because she can't read them, and then finally she kills the whole family. And the book is told only from her point of view, how she grew up, why she never learned to read. It's fascinating.
Well, I don't think I'm dumping on mysteries.
No, I know you're not.
I know many of them are superior. Mm-hmm. It's just that they have many of them fit into a formula that doesn't work for many literary writers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't like formulas.
Are you a poet?
No, but I've written some librettos for operas and... Some songs for the composer Robert Starr. I like to write for music.
How do you do it? How do you write a libretto?
You just I work with the composer and we decide what we're going to do, and then I write lots of lines, and then he picks the best ones. And the nice thing about it is that I don't librettists are never remembered, or they're very often not remembered, so I feel anonymous. I find I have a great freedom when I I'm nobody.
But do you have to hum the music and you have to make the words fit, don't you?
I seem to be able to do that without too much problem. I write the words first, and then he sets it to music.
Uh-huh. I've always wondered about that. So when I hear classical music, I hear, Vivaldi's The Four Seasons. You know, if I didn't know that these were the four seasons, if they weren't described and titled, I might not know what he was writing about.
You might think that spring was fall or something.
Yeah, I mean, how can you tell? You can't, because music doesn't really tell you anything. There can be an uplifting element. It can be somber or it can be bright and so forth. So when you write the libretto first...
I don't do the whole thing. I'll just we'll do a scene together.
Well, does he tell you what? Say, do something about spring or do something about a person or what? I mean, how does it...
No, well, we just did one for a classical music announcer, Robert J. Lertzema. And we knew he could do any kind of voice. You know, he can pronounce all kinds of foreign names very well. So we did a piece called Remembering Felix. And all we knew from the beginning was it was different people remembering a dead musician, a man who's just died, a pianist who'd come from Poland and lived in this country. And we did different people. We did his accountant. We did his publicist. We did an old Viennese lady he took tea with, and she played the cello, and he played the piano. We did his students. We did two critics, one who hated his music and one who loved it. And I kind of just wrote it imagining myself as these people, but at the same time, I let my lines have a rhythm to them. And then I would write one section at a time, and then Robert Starr would set it to music.
Then what did you do with it?
We gave it to Lertzema, and he's just performing it like crazy all over the place.
Are you paid for this?
Oh, I think that the people who commissioned us did give us... Musicians don't get paid very much.
I know. That's why I wondered.
Poets don't either.
But it was a commission.
It was a commission.
Yeah,
yes.
It was
delightful.
Well,
it took me two nights to write it. I mean, because it just came.
Poets aren't interested in money anyway.
They better not be.
No, they don't. They don't care about that. They're, mm-hmm.
They just have immortality. That's all.
Well, some of them do, not every poet. Well, I've certainly enjoyed this meeting with you again, Gail Godwin. I didn't go into a lot of biographical things with you because my last interview with you, I think I took you back through the writer's workshop and your first book, which is still among the missing, I guess.
The very first book.
First manuscript.
First is still lost.
This is still lost.
I'm still looking for it.
Yeah, I can't remember the first sentence. I had that in the piece. So
what? Oh, I've forgotten the first sentence.
Well, you remembered it then.
Oh,
and
the last sentence of the
last sentence. Yeah. What is that last sentence?
The last sentence of the lost manuscript is, "If I can do it once, I can do it again. Thus rises the indestructible pyramid."
Well, every anonymous-looking book I see at the Strand Bookstore, I'll look at the back page looking for that last sentence.
No, it's the novel I sent off to that non-existent agency.
No, you have been ripped off.
Oh.
You can sue them. Gail Godwin, thank you very much.
You're welcome.